Chapter 13. Walking downstairs with your hands fastened behind your back is more difficult than you'd think. You depend upon your arms for balance, whether you realize it or not. With my hands cuffed at the small of my back, Murphy walked me up the narrow servant's staircase and then down the front steps of McFinn's building in front of a gaggle of staring police officers. My balance was gone. As we came down, I could hear arguing voices.
"You want to get in my face about this?" Carmichael demanded.
"Look, I'm doing my job. My boss says no one was to go up, so no one goes up. Do I need to use shorter words or what?"
I looked up to see Denton towering over Carmichael, the veins in his forehead athrob. His three associates spread out in a fan behind him.
"You are interfering with a duly appointed officer executing his duties," Denton snarled.
"Get out of my way, Detective Carmichael, or do you want to get added to Internal Affairs' to-do list along with your boss?"
"It's all right, John," Murphy said. "I'm done with my business up here anyway." Carmichael looked up at me and stared, his mouth opening. Denton and his crew looked too. I saw Denton's face twist in surprise, then close again, hedging out any emotion from his expression. Roger, the red-haired kid who'd worked for Denton, was staring at me openly, his jaw dropped open. Ben, the woman who had attacked Murphy last night, regarded me with an almost bored expression, and Wilson, the overweight one, let out a satisfied snort.
"Lieutenant," Carmichael said, "are you sure about this?"
"He was arguing with the most recent deceased last night. I can connect him to at least one resident of the house, as well as some of the decorations there. I'm taking him in for obstructing and for conspiracy to commit murder. Put him in the car, Carmichael, and then get your ass upstairs."
Murphy gave me a sharp push toward Carmichael, and I stumbled. Carmichael caught me.
"So let's go, Denton," Murphy said, and turned and stalked away. Denton gave me an expressionless face and stepped after Murphy, beckoning his companions to follow. Carmichael shook his head and walked me to one of the police cars.
"Fuck, Dresden. And here I was getting ready to throw in on your side. Guess I'm just a sucker for the underdog."
Carmichael unlocked the back of the car and put his hand on the back of my head as I bent down to get in.
"Watch your head."
"Christ, what happened to your jaw?"
I sat down in the back of the car and looked straight ahead. I didn't answer him.
Carmichael stared at me for a while and then shook his head.
"We'll have someone drive you downtown as soon as the scene is secure. You can get in touch with your lawyer then."
I kept my eyes forward and didn't answer him. Carmichael studied me some more, then stood and shut me into the car. I closed my eyes. I have felt low before in my life. I have experienced events that have left me broken and groveling and wishing I was dead. That was pretty much how I felt now, too. It wasn't that I hadn't found the killer. I've been beaten before, taken a blow to the chin, and come out fighting the next round. I can roll with the punches as well as anyone. But I hated the feeling I had betrayed a friend. I had promised Murphy that I would keep no secrets from her, and I hadn't. Not really. But I had been stupid. I should have been putting pieces together more quickly, more instinctively. Perhaps I had some excuse in that I'd been distracted by nearly having my head blown off at the Full Moon Garage, and that I'd been distracted by my soul gaze upon the Street Wolves' leader and the knowledge that he wanted to kill me. But it wasn't good enough to clear things with Murphy. I wasn't sure anything would have been. I felt alone. I felt frustrated. I felt like shit. And I felt worse a moment later when I looked out the car window at the full moon and realized something that I should have put together an hour before. The real killer, or killers, were still out there. McFinn couldn't have been responsible for all the deaths in the previous month. Two of the murders had occurred on nights before and after the full moon. If McFinn's curse was indeed to become a ravening beast during the full moon, he could not have murdered either of the last month's victims, or Spike at the Varsity last night. Which begged the question, who had done the killings? I didn't have any answers. If the dark-haired woman who had led the Alphas was indeed connected with McFinn, could she have been responsible? Something wolf-like had attacked me in the abandoned department store when all the lights had been out. Had it been her? One of the Alphas? Perhaps that would explain how the other murders happened. But if it had been true, why hadn't the killer finished me off while I was floundering in the dark, virtually helpless? More and more questions, and no answers. Not that it mattered to me now. A nice, quiet jail cell actually didn't sound too bad once I thought about it. Or at least, it would have kept the criminal element off my back, provided they didn't shut me up with a 400-pound con named Hump or anything. And then an odd feeling crept over me, derailing my train of thought. Once more, the hairs on my neck were standing up. Someone was watching me. I looked around. There was no one in sight. All the police were inside the house, and I was alone in the back of the patrol car with my hands bound. I was helpless and alone, and I suddenly became very aware of the fact that Harley McFinn had not been found or apprehended. He was still lurking in the night, unable to keep from tearing apart anyone he saw. I thought of Spike's torn corpse, of poor Kim Delaney, covered in her own blood upstairs in the townhouse. I added imaginary and far more horrible images of half a dozen other victims, stacking scene upon scene of blood and death in my mind within a few seconds. I broke out in a cold sweat and looked out the other window, directly into a pair of brilliant, feral, amber eyes. I yelled and flinched away, lifting my legs to kick should something come rushing through the vehicle's window. Instead, the door opened, and the dark-haired, amber-eyed woman from the department store said, "Be quiet, Mr. Dresden, or I will not be able to rescue you." I blinked at her, up over my upraised knees. "Huh? Rescue you, Mr. Dresden? Get out of the car and come with me, and quickly, before the police return." She peered past me toward the house. "There's not much time."
"Are you crazy?" I demanded. "I don't even know who the hell you are."
"I am Harley McFinn's fiance, Miss West," she said. "Call me Tara." I shook my head.
"I can't leave. I'll be buying more trouble than you can imagine."
Her amber eyes glinted. "You are the only one who can stop my fiance, Mr. Dresden. You cannot do that from a jail cell."
"I'm not the Lone Ranger," I snapped in reply. "I'm a hired consultant, and I don't think the city is going to foot the bill for this sort of thing."
Tara West's teeth showed.
"If money is your concern, I assure you that it is not a problem, Mr. Dresden. Time presses. Will you come or not?"
I studied her face. She had clean, striking features, exceptional more than attractive. There were crow's feet at the edges of her eyes and mouth, though they were the only sign of age on her that I could see. There was, along the edge of her forehead, at the hairline, a long, slender, purpling bruise.
"You," I said. "It was you who attacked me in the department store. I hit you. You took my rod away from me."
She glared at me.